Hello and welcome to Talking Scared. I'm your host, Neil McRobert, and this week we're on unsafe ground. You'll understand why when Joshua Hull tells us all about his debut novella, Mouth, because quite literally, it's a story that asks the question, what if the ground had teeth? So this is Joshua's first book. Prior to this, he made his name as a screenwriter with a penchant for grisly hilarity. You may have seen his movie, Glorious, on Shudder. If not, I definitely suggest that you do, because it's a hoot, and it also includes weird creatures and holes, which is a fixation we get into in this conversation, whilst also talking about classic creature features, B-movie sensibilities, forgotten American serial killers, and how to write far more lovable monsters than them. Now, as ever, yada yada, if you like this show, please leave a review on Apple or Spotify, and you can consider signing up to Patreon to receive a whole mass of extra episodes in the back catalogue and going forward every month. Just go to patreon.com/talkingscaredpod or use the link in the show notes. And if you do, I won't feed your feet first to the beast. But either way, come with me now to a secluded clearing out beyond the barn. Bring food, because it keeps the monsters on our side. Let's talk scared. Hi, Joshua, and welcome to Talking Scared. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I am great. I'm nice and relaxed and feeling all refreshed after a nice weekend, and I feel terrible because I've basically asked you to record this episode the day after probably your most stressful weekend of the year.
Yeah, it was a lot, but I'm rested. I'm excited to talk. It was, I am fully rested up and ready to go.
Good. What I'm referring to, listeners, is the event Scarelastic, which Joshua kind of is the major domo of. I'd heard of it, of course, but being overseas, the details had escaped me. I didn't know that you were the organizer until like a week ago. I wouldn't have suggested today. I'd have given you a week off to recover. But yeah, thanks for doing this. It's a good chance to raise the profile a little bit for next year for people who may not know. Tell us a bit about the event and how did it go?
Yeah, it's called the Scarelastic Book Fair. It takes place in McCordsville, Indiana, at the horror-themed brewery that I'm a part owner of, Scarlet Lane Brewing Company. It's a big love letter to the classic Scholastic Book Fair, but it's with beer, it's with horror, and it's with authors, publishers, and vendors. And this was the second year, and it was absolutely insane. First year, doing a first year event, I didn't know what to expect, and it went really well. And this year, it just exploded. So I have no idea what's in store for year three.
Well, I'll tell you what, I didn't know there was a brewery involved. So you're telling me that it's a horror event where all my friends are at, it's in a brewery, and it's in a state I've yet to visit. I have to come to this, Joshua. I have to be there at some point.
Absolutely. Please do.
That's amazing. Well, I'm glad it went well. And I think, lots of people in the horror community were following videos and photos online, and authors and fans, friends of the show tweeting about it. It looked great. So massive congrats. But as I say, thank you for doing this so quickly afterwards.
No. Thank you for having me. Yeah, it's been a lot. It's been a lot with the book and the Scarelastic right around at the same time. But it's fun and exciting. And I'm so grateful.
Did you get much chance to promote the book?
Yeah, we did a early release, actually. Matt from Tenebris was here in the building. And so he did an early exclusive release for the event. And we sold a decent number of copies to get it out there early. And it was very exciting.
Oh, excellent. Well, let's promote and sell a few more now, right? Because by the time this goes live, Mouth, your novella, is out in the world. Fabulous little beast that it is. Can you tell us a little something about your story?
Absolutely. It's about a drifter named Rusty who finds himself the caretaker of this massive tooth-filled creature in the ground of this property that he's left by a complete stranger after just a meeting one day. He doesn't know anything about this house that he's left, just that, he stumbles across this creature on the property, and he has to take care of it now. it's complicated by a filmmaker wannabe named Abigail, who follows him and discovers Mouth as well. And together they team up to figure out the history of Mouth and the man who used to own the property. And it just becomes this big, fun mystery about a mouth in the ground.
Yeah. Yes. My first question is kind of like, you know, what the fuck? My first question is, how did you conjure up this creature? Because the book's called Mouth and the creature is called Mouth. First and foremost, the creature. Where the hell did you land on that? The inspiration fascinates me.
Yeah, it was a weird idea from the start. It was just a relationship that I had with Tenebris. We were just going back and forth, and I had mentioned this concept that I had. And at the time, the original idea was more of a David Cronenberg sort of take on this creature in the ground. More goopy, more horrific, more just horrible creature. And then as I got into the writing process, it became so much more about Mouth and what he was, what he represented in my personal life, what he represented in, you know, what I was pursuing in a career wise. And it was just a big piece of myself that became this mouth in the ground.
I mean, it is such a charming idea. It shouldn't be, because it's about animals and people being eaten by a sort of serrated mouthed, horrible creature in the ground. But it is just such a charming idea. To bookend this conversation, at the end, I want to talk to you about a film that you wrote called Glorious, which a lot of my listeners may have seen. It's on Shudder. Yeah, we'll talk about that later. But just for now, to explain, Glorious revolves around, well, a kind of glory hole in a public bathroom stall. So glory holes and mouth holes. I mean, how Freudian do you want to take this conversation, Joshua?
Yeah, you know, I knew it was a question that was coming, and a lot of people do ask me this question. The funny thing is I have written things in between these projects, but these are just the two that are going to come out next to each other, which is very funny because I am the whole guy now. but I you know, there was a lot of flirting early on in the project with possibly connecting the two, just in sort of a loose way, just because, you know, it's hard to write a movie about a hole and then follow it up with a book about a hole and not like have some sort of connection there. But I pulled away from that just because I wanted them to both stand on their own, in their own universes. But there's references, and I thought about referencing more. But yeah, it's a whole thing, if you will.
Is there something about holes that scares you? Because I was wondering whether you had, you know, that phobia that people have where little holes scare them. I wonder whether you had like the big hole version of that, that it's just holes are on your mind all the time.
No, I do not have a hole phobia. I probably do now after having to talk about them for 3 years straight.
You said something there a moment ago about how it represents certain things in your life. You allude to that in the afterword. I'm not going to pry into your personal life at all, Joshua. I don't do that. It's not appropriate. What I will ask you is this, though, because then you can say whatever the hell you want. What I would say is this is a very fun project, a very fun novella, whatever, we'll get to that. Very fun piece of writing. But it does feel like there is sort of emotional intent hidden away within it. Because there's one of the things I notice is this repeated sort of theme or refrain or whatever about not being burdened down by your mistakes. That's something that's said by quite a few characters in different ways. And it feels like there's a vein of something serious running under this B-movie monster concept. Is that anywhere near accurate?
Oh, it's 100% accurate. You know, I was... There's... When you had Nat Cassidy on and talked about Nestlings, I was blown away by his honesty in that interview, you know, and it was just a beautiful, and I said, I'd do the same thing, on the episode, because I really thought that would connect with a lot of people. But yeah, so I was going through a divorce, pretty heavy divorce during the writing process of this, where, you know, there was a lot of people upset, a lot of people hurt, a lot of just changes in life. I was, you know, sort of bouncing around houses, which is sort of where the rusty drifter aspect comes into it. So a lot of this is me working through that entire process. 3 or 4 months of just really, really terrible things and really new things, but also exciting renewal and sort of forming my own path, or not my own path, but, you know, beginning life anew again with certain things. And just, it's all in the pages, you know, every character from Wayne to Rusty to Abigail to Mouth is me in a different aspect, you know, just all trying to have hope and rebirth and a new start in their own way that they can, you know, even though they have regrets and pain and they've caused maybe a world of devastation to people in their life. So yeah, it was just me working through that entire process.
Well, thanks for your honesty. It's always nice when people are honest about stuff like that, because it gives me something more to chew on. But I just don't like to force people into corners with stuff, you know. Considering you were going through all of that stuff, and I'm really not being literal here and suggesting you wanted to feed your ex-partner to a hole in the ground, but was there an element in which writing about something where you can literally, like, dispose of pain and dispose of negativity in your life in this just such a, you know, Mouth is just like a human trash disposal system. You can put all of your stuff into this and just get rid of it, and it's never seen again. Do you think there was something in that that was going on about wanting to put your stuff somewhere?
Yes, yeah, there is exactly that, where so many things were eating away at me. You know, so many things were just became this constant mouth of every day I would wake up and there was something else eating away at either my, you know, my mental state or my physical state or just anything that would come with a big life change like that. And having this project to put all of that into, and yes, having a mouth to feed all of that into, was absolutely crucial in getting through that stretch.
Well, and when you see it finally come to fruition, you know, you've got your books out now. It's out from Tenebris, so it looks beautiful, because Tenebris do that. You know, you've got these gorgeous illustrations inside. The cover's really striking. And what's that feeling like? Like, is it a cathartic thing? Is it something else? How does it feel to the product of all that pain on the page, and now it exists for other people to read?
It's overwhelming. The entire process up to this point has been overwhelming. Just the writing was one thing, but, you know, when you're, it's such a solo experience when you're writing something like this, and you don't get to share it with anybody for months and months. Mm. And then when people start reading it and you're seeing them connect to the messaging, you know, the hope, the rebirth, the everything that comes with what I wanted to put into this book, what I was trying to put in the book, and seeing the reaction. So, you know, up to this point has been really surreal, but then holding it in my hands and seeing the impact that it has had on the people closest to me who went through that process with me it's really been overwhelming, and it truly like a beautiful experience. That sort of is a full circle moment, you know,
yeah,
for the entire project.
It's funny you talk about it being a sort of isolating experience, though, because when I was reading it, I was aware of you primarily. I mean, we started talking because of your screenwriting. I think we first spoke about, I can't remember, but I know that originally we talked about film writing on Twitter, and then you had this book, and we finally got together on this conversation. But I knew you in a kind of cinematic way. And all of your characters, the three main characters in this book, are cineasts in one way or another. And they talk in movie references. And it gives the impression that movies are your vocabulary, your kind of prism, you know. So considering it is such a solitary pursuit, writing a book, why did you write this as a piece of fiction? Why not a screenplay or a collaborative piece of work?
it was never going, this concept would never work, or originally it was not built to be a movie or a screenplay. This was always designed from the offset as a novella. And I just think that's because there's the screenwriting side of me that is very much into, you know, this is a collaborative effort. This is going to have so many hands involved with it, you know, and that's just how the process of making a movie goes. And then there's the process of sometimes you have these stories that you want to tell that you just want to tell yourself, and you just want it to be solely a journey that you have to get through on your own. And I felt like strongly with everything going on in my personal life, that Mouth was very much a journey I needed to take on my own. And sharing it with, you know, with Alex and Matt is one thing, but sharing it with an entire, you know, production team or something like that, where it takes the entire journey into, it's a group effort now for me to write everything that I'm feeling. I just felt like the better place for that was in the pages of this novella, where only 3 to 4 of us would have our hands on it at the end of the day.
Okay. Yeah. I've had Alex on the show for her novel Whisperwood, and I imagine she's an incredible partner in this kind of thing because she's so positive.
Yeah, it was a wonderful experience. This was my first time writing, you know, not a nonfiction book or anything. So it was really a hard transition going from the screenwriting style to doing this. And a lot of that did bleed into the edits, where, you know, Alex was very great by pointing out screenwriting is a different form. And so you can say from, you know, tell from all POVs as you're writing it, but it has to be, you know, there was a lot of great notes that I would just overthink, just because everything I do is so focused on screenwriting.
Yeah.
That it does bleed itself into, and was probably a big old headache for her. But we made it. We got through it.
And was it your choice or their choice to go for novella length rather than novel?
It was always a novella. It was always going to be a novella. Just from the start, there was never any talk about making it a longer project. Mm. It had a very clear cut beginning and in middle, or sorry, I just completely did that backwards. but the structure of that makes sense. You know, obviously you've read the book, so you know, it does a lot of weaving with different timelines. And I think that was always very clear that there was never going to be an extended version of this or something that needed to be told in more than 250 pages. It was all a very small story.
Okay.
To me.
Well, you say that, and it's certainly, it works as a compact story, but like, I have a thing with novellas. I think, the flip side of what I was about to say, lots of people make this point that very few novels deserve to be novels. Most good ideas should be short stories. It's this kind of thing that people say. And I often think people have just been a bit snooty when they say it. Because I love a novel. I love a big, expansive story. And quite often with novellas, my take on them is this story is too slight. It's you've got an idea and you don't have a story to go with it. That's off, not always. I mean, there've been some great novellas on this show, but I quite frequently am unsatisfied by novellas because there isn't enough there. In this, you've got two really interesting central characters, a fabulous monster. You've got a whole history of serial killing. And then there's these two other subplots that are each about a different kind of revenge. And that's easily enough to support a sort of 300, 400 page novel. So I'm always just interested in why people opt for a shorter form, because I think this could have been either.
Oh, yeah. I appreciate you saying that. I think for me, it's personally like a novella is very good for me because it is right along the same page length of what a screenplay is.
Right.
You know, so it's very much in that, 120 pages. Mm-hmm. A novella is so breezy and easy and fun to write. And then for me, the novel is, oh, this is going to take a while to get through, and that's okay. But I've written a novel that's going to come out, and for me, the process of writing that novel was so intense. The idea of the novella is such a beautiful thing to me, and I have so much fun doing it.
I'm just glad to read a novella that had sort of enough story in it that it wasn't just hinging on one concept. Do you know what I mean by that?
Yeah, for sure.
I sound too negative. There are some great novellas. I've had some on the show, but I want more story, if not necessarily more pages. And anyway, you gave me that.
Yeah.
Something just occurred to me that this is a complete left field, sideways adjacent segue. This, it's got nothing to do with anything I was asking you about, but I mentioned serial killers, and I just want to say you did in this book something that I didn't think was possible anymore, because I'm a twisted bastard, and you introduced me to a whole new horrible real life serial killer. A brief reference to a Herb Bauermeister, who I'd never heard of. He sounds a right charmer. Is he kind of like a local Indiana boogeyman?
Yeah, he's the big one. Carmel, Indiana is where his property was. And yeah, it just like it says in the book, they are still finding bodies to this day of his. So yeah, he is a very big deal around here.
I dashed straight off to Wikipedia after I read about that, because I have to know these things. If ever I read anything where I think, is that real or is that fictional? I have to know. Yeah. And he, was that part of an inspiration? Because like Rusty, he buys a property that is basically littered with bodies, right?
Yeah, it was a little bit of an inspiration. It really was just something that found itself seeping into the story. I didn't really outline Mouth at all. I was just letting the story unfold as I was writing it. And I don't usually do that, but this one was coming to me so naturally that anything that would sort of spill in from my knowledge of the area, you know, since it is Indiana set, I did want to be loyal to the area and the state in general. And so I just think when you're dealing with, you know, a serial killer story, then that is Indiana. It's hard to gloss over Herb.
Mm. I loved finding out about him. And I was also creeped that I didn't know about him, because there's something quite aside from what he did, there's something quite creepy that he could do that and the entire world isn't aware of him. You know, that is in itself an eerie fact.
Yeah, absolutely.
It just goes to further drive home my idea that I've said before on this show, that too much focus is placed on coastal Gothic in America. All horror stuff tends to be set in either the Oregon woods or like Massachusetts and New England, where I find the middle of the country much creepier to think about, just because it's so big. There's so much going on that people just may never, ever know. Right now, there could be things happening, you know, in Indiana that people would never know about just because of the size of, like, the place. And when you find about a serial killer who killed all these people, I don't even know about him, I just find it so eerie.
Right, right. Yeah, no, it just kind of also shows you, you know, there's just so much of that out there that somebody like him can be only sort of like a regional name, you know, because there is, it's scary and wild, it's definitely he's definitely a person that I don't want to say deserves like the Dahmer treatment or like the Seer, you know, like, but there's definitely a Fincher-esque Zodiac story that would be really cool to do around that timeline and that story, but you know, I don't know if that's an appropriate thing to do, and there's a reason why it hasn't been done probably. But it is just a scary thing about how unknown people like that can be.
Yeah. I mean, I sound like one of these creepy fanboys now, because I've spent enough time on this show making a point that we shouldn't celebrate these arseholes, you know, and I'm now like frothing at the mouth trying to talk about him. But no, it's not really about him. It's more about, as I say, these quiet pockets of America that, for me, on the other side of the Atlantic, where everything's so congested over here, it just fascinates me, the idea of these rural landscapes where these things go on. And people like him and people like Ed Gein and all that, they kind of represent it in my mind. So I've started reading books like yours and like Ron Malfi, people who write from the parts of the country that aren't typically gothicized. I really enjoy them.
Yeah, it's a fun genre. It's a fun area and to play with. And I Malfi was at Scarelastic, so I just got to actually spend a lot of time with him on Saturday, and it was so much fun.
Yeah, he's one of my favourites. Such a good writer. Such a good writer. Such a good drinking buddy as well, I found.
Yes, yes, I did learn that as well.
Well, from one really unpalatable monster in real life, let's get to your, you know, much more endearing character, Mouth. He is completely inexplicable. All we literally know of him, he's a mouth and a sort of throat. That's all we really see, even though there's an image of him in the book. Were you ever tempted to dig, that's no pun, to dig deeper into his origins?
I was not. Alex and I talked about it early on, and there's references throughout that maybe he's something more than just a mouth. Maybe there's a full body under that ground. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe there's a gigantic thing. But I like the way of leaving this a mysterious sort of entity that mouth is. My favorite reaction has been everybody wants a pet mouth. You said it yourself on Twitter, which or a friend mouth. But, you know, I would have never expected that. And I think it's so funny. And I think if you give the origin or anything like that, then you lose the, I don't want to say charm, but you do lose the charm of mouth in the book if we did that.
But the charm is the word, because he's charming. He's not an evil creature. And I want to ask about that from a sort of craft sense, but I don't want to speak to get that deep into it. But, you know, your book doesn't go full Little Shop of Horrors. It's not that thing where the monster starts as quite charming and then reveals its real malignancy. He kind of remains an innocent throughout. And how did you set about doing that? How do you make a people-eating creature so endearing?
This another conversation that we had early on was how to make Mouth interact. And there was, you know, obviously coming off of Glorious, we did not want Mouth to speak, because it just, you know, it gets too, there's one thing about writing two whole things next to each other, but if you write two talking holes, then it just becomes this whole entire thing. And you know, that was the last thing I needed, was to be the talking hole guy. I'll just be the whole guy. But the idea was how to make him communicate in a way that the characters and audience would both connect with. And for me personally, it was looking at the work of two things. It was James Gunn and how he creates these characters that should never, you know, be as adorable as they are, you know, in some of his movies, or how he creates these entire fan bases around these adorable creatures. That was one aspect. And then the other was my sister-in-law is an ASL interpreter. And so I wanted to dig into how she pulls off, you know, communication and merge those two worlds in bringing Mouth alive and making him sort of this beautiful, sweet creature that is just, if you will, sort of a baby that doesn't know what it is and what it's doing. And it's being raised by maybe the wrong person at some point, And then it's been adopted by people that can sort of form it into its own thing, into its a fresh life, and making him just innocent and charming was the best way to do that.
That idea that monstrosity needn't be negative, that again is baked right into the story, because Rusty thinks that your main character, to reiterate, who inherits Mouth, he's thinking back to the monster movies he watched as a kid and how he always saw what he calls the beauty and the beasts, and he refers to monstrosity as a badge of honor. Is that something you're channeling from your own childhood or later, or what? Is that your point of view?
A little bit. I was raised, you know, like much like Rusty's character is. My mom and I would watch horror movies a lot while I was growing up, and I fell in love with the idea of the beauty in the monster. I mean, that's why we're all monster kids. That's why we're all horror fans. Mm-hmm. It's not just in the creation of the creatures, but also the literal creation of these creatures, the art and the word that goes into it. And I was always attracted to that. I always loved that aspect of horror movies. And, you know, it's the oldest trope in the world is that man is the true monster. But I wanted to play with that in a way, in my own unique way, that sort of gave a fun spin to that. And yeah, I just think growing up and watching, you know, all these movies and just being a human in this world, it was like, yeah, there's a way to do this and to connect with those sort of stories from my youth and those feelings from my youth and bringing it into sort of the ugly, monstrous world that we all find ourselves living in right now.
Well, I think it particularly works these days. I mean, the best quote I've ever heard on this was Guillermo del Toro, who, you know, like, no one knows monsters like Guillermo del Toro. Mm-hmm. And he had this quote that monsters are the patron saints of imperfection. And I think that is more relevant now than it's ever been. In an era in which we're all imperfect, but desperately trying to hide the fact that we are, you know, and desperately trying to be perfect in the public gaze and everyone's eyes, and you know that the social media thing between the life we project and the life we live and all that, it feels like monsters are more necessary than ever to to represent that it's okay to not be perfect.
Right, which is definitely a theme as well with Mouth, and a theme with Rusty and Abigail and how they take care of him is we all don't have to be perfect, but we can at least try to be. You know, and whatever happens, happens. But as long as we're all trying to be better than the horrible people out there, then everything should work out okay.
Yeah. We try. Yeah. So I'm going to ask a question now that I was sort of deliberating over asking or not, because I really don't want it to sound offensive. Right? Bear with me. All the way through, I felt like you were really channeling this love for B-movies and pulp cinema into the book, because your characters, Abigail and Rusty, Abigail in particular, is obsessed by these kind of B-movie type classic rubbery monster flicks from the 60s and 70s and the 80s. So the book feels like an intentional B-movie. There's a kind of hysteria, and if you'll permit me, a kind of intentional cheesiness to Mouth. Kind of these one-liners and a sort of grindhouse aesthetic, and it read like a homage to Roger Corman. Is that fair? Have I just like massively insulted your book?
No, that's totally fair. Yeah, I would agree with that 100%. I think, you know, it's a product of, again, of the movies that I would watch growing up, and but also movies that I, you know, encountered in my own adulthood that I, you know, was never aware of, or, you know, definitely the Roger Corman, the Ed Wood, the all that stuff, it all is in the DNA of this book. Mm. And that's definitely on purpose, because it's even, you know, that's Wayne's story, is how, you know, he wanted to be this serious filmmaker, and instead he ended up doing these sort of cheapy horror movies that were on shoestring budgets. And the idea of that is you have no idea how those impact people. Those kind of movies have the same impact on people that John Ford movies do, mm-hmm. but those people never really get to see it, you know? And that's the idea of Wayne's story as well, is that, you know, he thinks he was a failure, but he has this whole room that he kept a piece of that failure because it was the closest he ever got to that dream. So he could see that every day. And now Abigail's seeing it, and now Rusty's seeing it. And you know, who else will see it eventually. And that was on purpose, was to show that regardless of how small a movie is, or how big a movie is, or how perceived good or bad or anything like that, movies impact people, and they have this profound impact on who watches them. And yeah, so that was all purposely put into the book.
That's great. I hadn't thought about that, about, yeah, legacy. And he has kept those things. Wayne is, sorry to explain to listeners, Wayne is the original owner of Mouth, who has passed the baton on to Rusty. And he's a sort of, well, up until you just said that, I was going to say a failed filmmaker who has kind of retired with his bitterness to this house. But yeah, he's kept this room. So clearly there is some kernel of his work that he holds dear. Yeah, I never thought it's quite a touching little way of seeing it. I never thought about that.
And we can all connect to that too. It's like, personally, I've done it where I made some movies and I feel like they did not hit the mark, you know, for what I was trying to do with a shoestring budget or with career wise, you know, where you have a big pie in the sky aspirations and then they just don't hit the mark. But then you find out, you know, 10 or so many years later that, oh, these people, somebody watched that and they loved it and it had this profound impact on them. And it's a unique way to look that not everything is a failure. It's just sometimes things take time and you know, I don't want to defend Wayne because he's a pretty, but I do think that there is, you know, it goes back to the beauty in the monsters and maybe there is a little bit of beauty to Wayne as well that got away from him just because everybody else gave up on him.
Yeah, we don't want to defend Wayne, but I will say that I think anybody who's ever made anything creative and had that thing pissed upon would love to own a hole in the garden that they can put people into. You know, that's all I'm saying. There's a few people I would feed into mouth given the chance, you know. But I mean, I'm glad you gave the answer though, because I was a bit nervous to ask about that B movie aesthetic. It could be taken the wrong way. What I think it shows is something I've always believed, that it is very possible to take your work seriously without making it serious. And Mouth is full of these like grindhouse cool lines that, you know, the two that I picked out, there's early on when Rusty first sees Mouth, he passes out in shock. And when he wakes up, you write, "The cool fall breeze smacked stonewashed urine against his thigh." And I thought, what a wonderful sensory detail that is. And then later, just in case listeners think where this is going to get a bit grim and gory and gross and too serious, you later off finish one paragraph. There's a real ethical quandary and you finish it off with this line. "It was a real predicament for a man newly in charge of a subterranean cake hole." And I just thought, yeah, there is a real kind of funny, satirical, non-serious tone to this.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, that was all there. And, you know, I don't know if I put that in there as like, you know, not as like grindhouse or stuff, but there, but, you know, very cinematic, very funny. Imagery and writing is very much what I like to do. And so I wanted to really hit Rusty with it. There's a lot more there that I really find funny. They feel like, now that I think back on it, of those like cheesy one-liners and stuff. And that's really funny because that wasn't the goal, but a lot of people that I know do not like my sense of humor, like, cause they hear it all the time. And so when I put it in a book, you know, they all will roll their eyes cause they're like, "Oh my God, I can hear you saying this." And it's just so, but you know, for new readers and new people, it's always fun to see the reaction to some of the ridiculous stuff that I put in writing.
Yeah, I want to clarify my use of the word cheesy. What I'm talking about is there are things that people say that it's like an 80s movie where you think that's the coolest possible thing someone could have said in that situation. You know, like in the 80s, people got to say the thing that you wish you could say in that situation. You never did. And there's a lot of that vibe in it. It feels like there's a bit of Amblin to it, you know, a bit of Amblin movie style neatness to it. I think that's what I mean by cheesiness. I mean kind of satisfying.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, not offended at all by that, the cheesy aspect at all, because that, I mean, that is the point of Abigail's entire character is raised on the Amblin movies, you know. That's why she's constantly referencing, you know, the Goonies and things like that.
Well, can we talk just briefly about classic monster movies, because their influence is everywhere in Mouth. Both like your story itself is a classic monster story and it's full of these references we've talked about. Do you have favorites or anything that applied to the book, or just generally do you have classic monsters that you really love?
I mean Frankenstein is the big inspiration and the big love of my life, if you will, when it comes to classic monsters. I just, the design, the everything about that story is so beautiful and just so well done, and it's just something you can revisit over and over again. You know, there's no getting tired of Frankenstein. You know, Godzilla is another one where that I just adore all those all those moves. That's part of my year has been just rewatching all the classics and all the old fun, just cheesy. Speaking of fun and cheesy, you know, that's the goal, is sort of a love letter to those rubber suit movies. And yeah, so I would say Frankenstein and Godzilla are the two big ones.
Okay. Okay. See, that's quite classic and highbrow. So I'm gonna hit you now with a completely left field thing that like three people will have seen. But have you ever seen the 1985 movie Enemy Mine, starring Dennis Quaid?
I have not.
Oh, listeners, if anyone has seen this movie, please just write into me. Okay, like please, like talkingscaredpod@gmail.com. It was my favorite movie when I was a kid. My dad says I once watched it 7 times in a row over a weekend.
Wow.
I was far too young. It's like a 15. It's full of horrible violence. But it's about Dennis Quaid and this guy played by Lou Gossett Jr., who plays an alien called Drax. And they're in like a war. And they land on this planet, this uninhabited planet. And it's full of, and they hate each other, but they've got to work together to survive. I think it's a reference to some classic Civil War story that I can't quite remember. But there is a monster in this pit. And all you see of it, it's this ingenious design. There's this pit of like sand that once you fall in, you can't climb out. It just keeps collapsing. And in the middle is this monster that all you see is its barbed tongue that comes flying out and grabs around a limb and starts pulling its prey in. And then eventually you see the, what it's essentially this massive subterranean beast that emerges. And as a kid, it blew my mind. And thank you so much, because I'd forgotten its existence. And for like all the way through reading Mouth, I was like, what is this reminding me of? And then it struck me, it's the pit in Enemy Mine, and I'm going to go and watch it. And you have returned my favorite movie to me from when I was like 9. You should definitely watch it too.
Yeah, I will. I will. I'm going to watch it 7 times in a row just for you.
Yeah, that's exactly the way to go. Yeah. Seems a good way to move into movies and your work in cinema. Glorious, as we started off, you know, the film about, I'm going to say about the glory hole, but it's not. It's about the Lovecraftian deity behind the glory hole that's trapped in the bathroom stall, right? But so it was directed by Rebecca McKendry. I believe it was, she a friend of yours before you started working together, or was it through Glorious that you became acquainted?
We knew of each other. I have obviously been a fan of hers for years and years and years, going all the way back to, you know, when she was doing, I mean, she's been with Fangoria, and you just always just a prominent horror person and a voice, always reliable voice in horror. So I always knew her and knew of her. And we had exchanged some emails over the years, but it was never like, we didn't even meet for the first time in person until Glorious was screening in her hometown in Virginia.
Oh, wow. So because of COVID, I'm assuming.
Yeah, just COVID and being in Indiana and she's in LA, you know, I don't get to meet a lot of people, which is why we get serial killers, I think, but that's okay.
well, yeah, I mean Rebecca McKendry is great. So for listeners who don't know, she's got she's a director, but she's also got a great horror movie podcast for Fangoria called Colors of the Dark, which I recommend. I'd like to get her on the show, actually. But how did you get involved with that, if you're in Indiana during under COVID conditions and she's over in LA?
Yeah, so I tried to, Glorious was a movie that I was trying to make here in Indiana for years. It was just never coming together the way that I was hoping for. And there's really, obviously, this is going to shock a lot of people, but there's not really a big film scene in Indiana. And so it's really hard to make movies here. And after so many starts and stops, I had just finally shut it down on my end, just, you know, kind of given up on the project as far as directing it. And then this was sort of right as COVID was starting, March 20, sort of like to shutdowns. And my friend, Jason Goldberg, he's one of the producers on the movie, basically just said he was looking for scripts to read while he was at home. And so I sent a movie I wrote about the making of Evil Dead. It's sort of like The Disaster Artist, but about you know, Sam and Bruce and all of them stuck in the woods, and he loved it, but he was like, I'm looking for something to produce, and that's way too big. And he said, do you have anything else? And I said, yeah, I have a script about a Lovecraftian glory hole. And he was just like, send it to me. And so I sent it to him on, I think, like a Wednesday, maybe. He read it in one sitting. He said, I have a friend that would love this. Can I send it to her? That friend ended up being Rebecca. She read it, I think, by Friday. The three of us were on a Zoom that Sunday agreeing to make the movie. So it was it was like within 5 days of him getting the script and her getting the script that we had all agreed that she was going to come on and direct the movie based off my script.
Oh, how cool. God, that must have been exciting.
Very much. Because I was such a fan of her. So it was when I found out he was sending the script to her, it was obviously nerve wracking, but it's right up her alley of everything she likes. And so, yeah, it just, everything aligned perfectly. And just turned out perfectly as well.
And there's another fabulous monster in that one. So you've referenced him as Gat, short for Gatanathoa, although I'm not going to hold my tongue to say it like Ryan Quantin has in the movie. So in the movie, Gat is a sort of big, horrible, hulking, gross ball of something that's stuck in this bathroom stall. And he keeps talking about his dad. And geeks like me know the daddy in question is the big boy himself, right? It's Cthulhu. I am right on that.
Yes. Yes, sir.
Okay, right. So we've got an eldritch cosmic entity trapped in the bathroom stall and voiced by J.K. Simmons. What a casting win that must have been.
Yeah, it was huge. It was he's a massive Lovecraft fan, so it was, you know, he was all in.
Is he really?
Yes. Yeah, that's the interest was there because of it. And yeah, he is a big, big Lovecraft person.
Oh, that's me writing to J.K. Simmons to come on the show then. I had no idea about that. That's the best piece of information I've had all week. But it is, I mean, to close all this in a nice, neat bow, and you've alluded to it right at the start, there is connective tissue between Gat and Mouth, you know. And I'd sort of say it's the lovable monster, but also the juxtaposition of the grindhouse every day and the truly otherworldly. Do you recognize that in your own work? Is that your horror aesthetic, do you think? Or is it just coincidence?
I think it's a part of my aesthetic, definitely. I do think I'm fascinated by the otherworldly. I'm fascinated by these creatures that, you know, have inspired and impacted so much of the genre, you know, every aspect of the genre, these creatures. And, you know, and it's hard not to let that seep into your writing, be it inspiration or just be it in general. And I do think that Glorious did impact me moving forward of how to write these creatures better than I ever have, just because seeing the reaction to Gat in that movie and seeing the moments, the horror hits and the comedy hits and the emotion, you know, even the aspect of when Gat is talking about how beautiful the world is, you know, and he doesn't want to see it end, that there is that carries into all of my work at this point, just because as a father, as, you know, a person, just as a person who has a ton of people that he cares about, you don't want to see anything bad happen to this place. And so when you encounter these creatures, these world ending creatures, if you will, I like putting them in a positive light, because maybe they're just like us at, you know, being their own size, or maybe they're just like us and just looking for a connection. And so, yeah, I do think that is how I write these things. Yeah.
It's like I said before, you know, it's that thing, taking something very seriously without making it serious. Everything you've said, there's like a deeper resonance to what you're doing, even though it's never weighty or dull on the screen or the page. You know, I like that. I enjoy that little juxtaposition.
Thank you.
And with that in mind, what's next for you then?
So I'm doing my novel debut will come out next July. That's with Clash. And so I'm very excited about that. That's going into the edit process now. And then I'm going to be writing a novella for Shortwave. I'm doing one of their killer VHS series, which I'm really excited about. It's going to be a Bigfoot thing. That's going to be a lot of fun. And then I have a couple movies nearing production. I think that should go into production by the end of the year or in the next few months. So it's a lot of fun and a lot of irons in the fire.
Okay.
But I'm having fun.
Briefly then. Okay. There's a lot. I mean, that's busy. I think I'm busy, but like, what can you tell us? Starting with the novel, can you give us any kind of idea what it's about?
Yeah, so it's about the house I grew up in, and I know that's going to get so much groans. But I grew up in 8 acres of a barn, a house, like farm property that was pretty abandoned when we moved in. So it was a lot of fixing it up throughout my time there. But it was a pretty haunted experience living in that house, and still remains that way. It's still an abandoned property that's sitting in the town I still live. I grew up in the town. I still live there. I do everything I do out of my hometown still. And this house is literally probably 3 blocks away from where I live now. And it is the scariest place and has some of the scariest memories of my life. And so I had this dream that one of my best friends committed suicide in that house. And I decided that I would write that book about a friend kills himself in this house. And then the friend moves back home to figure out why he did so. It's truly like it's Bret Easton Ellis meets Scott Derrickson Sinister. It's a very intense and scary book.
Do you have a working title?
Yeah, it's called 8114. That was the address of the house.
Nice and neat. Well, that sounds great. So I love a man returns home to face demons story. So that sounds right up my street.
Yeah, it's like I said, it's intense. It's people who read Mouth are going to be like, what the hell happened between Mouth and 8114. So it's a lot of it's definitely a personal story, but I think it's a lot of fun though. Horror fans will have a lot of fun with it, I think.
Great, and the Bigfoot thing sounds fun with Shortwave. They do lovely little production on their books, and I'm really thinking I'm a Bigfoot nut. I tell him all the time that the first chance I get on this show, I just start talking about Bigfoot. So what I may have to do one of these days is do a special episode where I get a few Bigfoot enthusiasts or people who've written Bigfoot stories, and we have a good old talk about what we actually think is in the woods. So maybe I'll hit you up for that.
Yeah, that'd be a lot of fun. Yeah, it's gonna be a fun one. It's more of a comedy. Mm-hmm. It's horror, but it's definitely gonna have the lighter tone to it.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. Well, that's your forthcoming books. Could you do my now standard thing and recommend a book that you think my listeners should read by somebody else?
I'm going to recommend, it doesn't come out until April 23rd from Ghoulish Books, but Laurel Hightower's new one, The Day of the Door. It is terrifying. It's The Haunting of Hill House meets A Head Full of Ghosts, and it is very, very scary. It is a scary book. And in a pure Laurel fashion, it's you know, heart-wrenching. It's about family. It's terrifying. Trevor Henderson did the art for the cover, and if you just look at the cover of this book, it'll give you nightmares.
I already know which cover you're talking about. I've seen it a few times pop up on my Twitter feed, and it stops you in your tracks when you see it, and it's very Trevor Henderson. I will try and get my hands on a proof of that to read, because you just named two of my favorite books as comps. So. Yeah.
Yeah, it's very good. It's very, very good.
Okay, and it's called The Day of the Door.
The Day of the Door.
Day of the Door. Okay, cool. And my last question, when was the last time something really scared you, Joshua?
So it's going to sound a little cheap and probably a lot of people will have their doubts, but it was during the process of writing 8114, where, you know, I had experienced a lot of scares at that property growing up. And as I started writing this book, they slowly started seeping back into my life, to the point where I started writing down that address on things that needed my address instead of my current address, you know. And then there were certain things happening to my girlfriend in the house that I live with. And then it all sort of culminated in a family canoe trip where my mom was telling me about nightmares that she was suddenly having about some woman stalking her, which is the same thing that my girlfriend was starting to see around. And it was very spooky because it was somebody, it was like a inspiration for one of the characters in 8114. So it was this very, it was a terrifying experience learning that, you know, these people in your life are having these nightmares or experiences. And then you start thinking, it's that whole, did I bring something back with this writing this book? And so, yeah, that was a terrifying process. And I was very glad to walk away from that book for a few months. I'm not very excited to dive back into the edits and reopen those, that entire thing. But yeah, that was terrifying. And the last time I was truly scared.
Wow. Okay. Well, I mean, you've titillated us enough here with stuff about this book. I feel that would be a fantastic conversation in and of itself. So let's get you back on next year when this comes out from Clash, because we haven't got time now, but I want to know all about your time in this house and your time writing about it. It just sounds like it's ripe horror conversation.
Outstanding. I would love to.
Cool. Yeah. I look forward to reading that very much, knowing what you've now told me. Right. Well, that's for next year. Right now, Mouth is out there chomping away. It's out from Tenebris Press, the great small press run by good people. As I've already said, it's a lovely book with really nice illustrations, and it's just a good time all around. So, yeah, I'm here championing Mouth. But for now, Joshua Hull, thanks for talking scared.
Thank you so much for having me.
So J.K. Simmons is a Lovecraft fan. Who knew? I must act upon this. And if you don't know who J.K. Simmons is, well, you actually do. He's the guy who played the evil drum teacher in Whiplash, or Jonah Jameson in Sam Raimi's Spider-Man. The man's a wonder, and my God, can he voice a well-meaning but irritated eldritch younger god with the weight of the world on its shoulders. This is basically me saying, A, J.K., come talk Lovecraft, and B, everyone else, go watch Glorious. For no other reason, it's a continuation of all the things that I liked about Mouth. A seriously made, unserious story, which is a style I've decided I quite like. So Mouth has no right to be as affecting and endearing as it is, just like its monster, to be honest. Joshua has written a properly ramshackle story. This shaggy dog tail. That's why the novella length works so well here. I was right to say that there is plenty of story for a novel if Joshua wanted to expand it, but by condensing it and distilling it, he keeps it fun and free of the constraints of nerdy plot logic. So, for example, how does Rusty come to inherit this land and Mouth? It doesn't really matter. The point is to get us where we need to be, which is a place with a toothed hole in the ground just ready for some backcountry justice. You can probably tell that I enjoyed this book. And I really do want to get him back on the show to discuss that Haunted House novel that he's writing, because it sounds like it's full of creepy anecdote and personal history, which is, you know, stuff I love. And sorry if you're cursing me for not asking more this time around, but it didn't feel right to plumb him for details before the book is even published. And plus, I'd want to get really into it, which needs its own episode. But it sounds great. I mean, it's scary enough to manifest in his family's dreams, which will definitely do for me. Yeah. Have any of you seen the film Enemy Mine that I mentioned? The one with Dennis Quaid and Lou Gossett Jr. on a far-flung planet. I did love it so, and this book did remind me of it. but I'm scared to watch it again after all these years in case it's secretly terrible. I remember it had a singularly remarkable ending, not at all like the typical, you know, grandiose, victorious violence of the 80s. It was something much more heartfelt and quite modern in its treatment of cultural tradition. That's my memory anyway. Let me know if you've seen it, because it's right back on my radar. For that, or anything else, you can email me at talkingscaredpod@gmail.com or find me on Twitter, Instagram, most of the other places at talkscaredpod. Got to say one thing, I'm inundated at the moment with requests to come on the show and talk about your books. And full disclosure, the calendar is almost entirely booked up for 2024. So by all means, get in touch and tell me about your book, you know, if you like. But be aware, I probably can't accommodate anything right now. Again, if you want tons more content and to help me keep making this show, the Patreon is available for a few units of your local currency. It's patreon.com/talkingscaredpod, and all reviews, however nice or scathing, are welcome. And I'm back next week, as ever, with the start of a pretty exciting spring on Talking Scared. Cynthia Pelayo is here, and I can't believe it's taken me this long to speak to her. She's going to be talking about the history and the lore and the horror of old Chicago and her new novel, Forgotten Sisters. And after that, it's Stephen Graham Jones back to finish our parallel trilogy of episodes about Jay Daniels and Indian Lake. So, lots to be excited about. But until then, brush your teeth thoroughly, watch old movies, and be proud of the things you create. Read good books, and remember, it's good to be scared.